call the Environment Policy Oversight Committee to order. And we do have the minutes to approve for March 11th.
I'd like to move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner moves the minutes for March 11th.
I'm so eager.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Signify by saying aye. 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 All opposed? Motion fails and the minutes are adopted. Welcome, Representative Kalin. And I will move your bill. House file 2634 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and members, appreciate your time. House file 2634 is a bill to extend the protection of the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer beyond the seven county metro area as is current law. Mr. Chair, we've been in Chisago County, we've been dealing with an issue related to a request to explore withdrawing as much as 5 million gallons of water a day for one time, essentially once through use. We've been working with the developer actually of a power plant the project will get voted on again tomorrow night. But there was a concern that we were able to work out with this specific developer limiting their access to the aquifer, and actually they've agreed not to access the Mount Simon Hinckley or any other aquifer for processed water. But the community has really been asking some pretty tough questions and been working with the local DNR water staff and others, and come to realize that the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer that is protected and was originally protected in the 1989 Groundwater Act limited withdrawals from that aquifer for potable water uses because it is the deepest aquifer in the state and has very limited recharge. I think that we all know that waters don't respect political boundaries, especially aquifers, and it's a fairly common sense approach. We've been working with the Senate and with our agricultural interests and the DNR to mollify some of their concerns, and I actually think that they've raised very important issues and have an amendment, the A-10-2330 amendment that you should have in your packets. That would reflect the compromise that we've been able to work out.
Okay, and I will move the A-10-2330 amendment to get it in the shape and form that the author would like. So yeah. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And walking through the DE amendment, the A-10 amendment, the first major change on Subdivision 4A removes the restriction to the Metropolitan Council territory, the metro area, as well as making, I think, an important change to the definition of potable water to domestic water. As we know that domestic water is a broader definition, I think that we certainly didn't want to limit in areas where the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer is the only aquifer available for general household purpose water. The paragraph B, we've been able to work with the Farm Bureau and other agricultural interests to allow for non-domestic uses up to 100,000 gallons a year, provided there are no feasible or practical alternatives and a water conservation plan is incorporated with the permit. This would only apply outside of the seven county metro area. We didn't want to allow any access to that deep aquifer within the seven county metro area, but wanted to very much understand that there are ag uses that may be implicated, and I would point to the map that you should have in your packets that show the location of the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer, and the darker area on that map is where it is or may be the only bedrock aquifer available, and those are really where the 100,000 gallon paragraph B uses may be permitted for non-domestic uses. So with that, Mr. Chair, I know that the DNR, Mr. Lacasmo from the DNR is available to testify. Mr. Lacasmo is making sure that I have my math right. It's 100 million gallons a year. If I said 100,000, I apologize. and so he's available to answer any other questions and correct any zeros that you may have, as well as Mr. Chris Raddatz from the Farm Bureau, who's been helpful. With that, I ask for member support and stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Kalin or for the DNR or Farm Bureau? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, we've got this other handout that appears to be a list of permits issued for public water users or water users from Mount Simon Hinckley. Is that what that is? There's no label in it.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, I believe these are actually all the accesses to the aquifer. You'll as you look down about a third down the or a third from the bottom of the front, the Winona County location is the Peerless Chain Company, et cetera. There's the Buffalo Lake Energy LLC. I believe this is these are all appropriation permits from the aquifer.
From the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Hackbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? I was just wondering if there's any opposition to the bill. Is there anybody in your district that opposes it? Any of those kinds of things?
Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify against or has concerns about the bill? Okay, I see none. And Representative Kalin, did you want to respond?
And then, Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, I have not heard any opposition at all to the bill, and it's been communicated multiple times via paper to the county board and multiple organizations.
And Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, what does the threshold of 100 million gallons, what type of activity does that exclude?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I think for these very, very large water users, potential water users, like, for instance, the combined cycle natural gas power plant that was originally proposed in our county, and they've since agreed to do a hybrid or an air-cooled technology that that's economically feasible. So I think those are the most likely users of anything more than 100,000 gallons a day, or 100 million gallons a year, excuse me. And I don't know if Mr. Lacasmo or Mr. Raddatz has any comments on the way you are, Chris.
Representative McNamara.
I'd like to hear from Mr. Lacasmo.
Welcome, Mr. Lacasmo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Kent Lacasmo, Director of the Division of Waters for DNR.
Director, if I may ask you, does the DNR support the bill, and what could be the implications if the bill passes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the major concern that we had with the bill as drafted was that there was no minimum threshold, and that's been addressed with the addition of the 100 million gallons a year. If you look at that list of projects, the bill still allows for municipal use or domestic use, and the majority of these appropriation permits that are larger than 100 million gallons a year are for municipal uses. There are some large industries, but those are existing permits. They continue. The potential impact would be if there's a new industry of some type that was proposing to use this this aquifer and they exceeded 100 million gallons a year, that would be restricted. So that could be an ethanol plant or some other major industry.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Lacasmo. If I understand this right, so if we had a new industry similar in size to Flint Hill Resources located in my neighborhood, an industry that supplies hundreds and in different times of the year thousands of jobs, do I read this right that they're 12 times as big as what would be allowed? So an industry 1/12 their size located outside the seven county metro area would not be allowed? I'm assuming this list is people that take from this aquifer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, this list is the appropriators from the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer, yes. And what this bill does is that would we would be precluded from issuing a permit for a use that's larger than 100 million gallons a year. Yes.
Representative Kalin.
And Mr. Chair, I think I know where Representative McNamara is maybe going. We currently have a requirement, I believe it's for more than 2 million gallons of water a day that from any aquifer for any water appropriation permit that there be legislative exemption to that limit, and this would obviously the legislature could provide exemptions for future projects accessing the aquifer, this specific aquifer, if so desired.
Representative McNamara.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, so you're changing it from 730 million gallons to 100 million gallons, if I understand what you just answered.
And
yeah, Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, for the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer, only outside the seven county metro area, correct? Because of the age of this and tenuousness of this specific aquifer.
Representative McNamara.
Can I ask, Mr. Chair, where is this bill going? Is this bill going to commerce and local government and places like that?
It's going to the general register.
Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion to change the direction of the bill to this bill should go to local government or energy. There should go to a number of places, commerce, if we're doing this, and I guess at some point I would like to entertain that idea that this bill has to go somewhere else. This is really huge, huge significance for industry. I mean, at this day and age when we're trying to attract industry to rural Minnesota, I guess, Mr. Chair, Director Lacushmo, what's the effect going to be in rural Minnesota with us lowering this to 1/7 of what it currently is, more than that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, without knowing what the next proposed high volume water use is, it's really difficult to answer that. I mean, certainly there's a lot of industry and a lot of manufacturing that uses less water than 100 million gallons a year. It's the large type things, like I mentioned earlier, an ethanol plant would exceed that, and there may be other industries. But without knowing what the potential is for that kind of industrial growth, it's difficult to answer.
And Representative McNamara, just to let you know, no other committees have requested this bill, and normally they do request bills if they so choose. Representative Kalin, did you want to respond?
And to that point, Mr. Chair, the bill has been out there for weeks, if not over a month, and I have not heard from anyone. The well drillers originally had some concern, but I haven't heard from them since the amendment was taken on in the Senate. I know that Mr. Lacushmo and the DNR had some concern, as did the Farm Bureau and other agricultural interests, and like I said, we've worked with them. I haven't heard any other concerns from industry, and I do know that it's regular practice for large projects to have to come before the legislature, but very, very, very few projects would be could be affected at all, and we found that rather than being the easiest solution, that there were other alternatives, specifically like the project in Chisago, the LS Power project that's chosen to do a hybrid or air-cooled project. Yes.
And Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, you mentioned that it would be a solution, and that's part of what I wonder is where the problem is. Have we had a well that takes over 100 million gallons a year somewhere that's somehow failed to protect our aquifer or something that is bringing this along? I'm curious what the problem is.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, the proposal from LS Power in Chisago County was what sparked the interest, and even the strongest advocates for the project have agreed that this is a good approach and something that we should do. Their original proposal would have required would have actually put them near the top of the list, actually probably number one on this list. 5 million gallons of water a day times 365 is more than the 1,500 million gallons that the city of Blaine is withdrawing. So that's what sparked the interest, and I think it's a reasonable approach and would still continue to allow development and protect our oldest and most fragile aquifer in the state.
Mr. Chair? Representative Jaskowski. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Kalin, I still don't understand. Just on the sheet alone, we've got, I'm going to guess there's 300 or 200 or whatever the number is, maybe 150 different.
264, okay. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you. 264 different entities that are currently drawing water from the aquifer. I would guess collectively, I don't know what the, I don't know how many billion gallons or hundreds of millions of gallons that represents, but I'm curious why we're looking at limiting one particular size of a well here and what problems we have had. I understand there was some sort of project in your area that I don't completely understand exactly what the details were there, but I don't know. Have our aquifers been polluted? Have there been? Are the big wells more likely to fail than a whole bunch of different smaller wells collectively? Do they all draw water, and is water volume the concern? Is it that we're going to somehow expose the aquifer? I still don't understand what the problem is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drakowski, the underlying statute that's being amended came from the 1989 Groundwater Act, which was prompted in part by the 1988 drought. And one of the concerns then was to protect the Mount Simon Aquifer. It is the deepest aquifer across the metro area, and it's kind of the savings account for water supply. And that bill, when it was drafted and passed in 1989, only addressed the 7-county metropolitan area. And this bill now expands it beyond to the entire aquifer that exists in Minnesota. So it's just another level of protection of the Mount Simon aquifer and the water supply that it could provide in the future.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Lacusmo, the issue that we're trying to address, it sounds like, is the level of the aquifer, or is what it's sounding like to me. Have we noticed or documented that the aquifer has run dry at certain times? What happened to the aquifer in the 1988 drought? Did it run dry and we ended up with people not being able to access the supply that's there before it had a chance to recharge?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drakowski, did it run dry? No. Are there impacts that are seen in the aquifer from seasonal pumping? Yes, there were, and there was some decline shown. One of the things that happened in this bill, now you'll see the stricken language, excuse me, in Section B, we had, at that time, there was a significant use of the Mount Simon Hinckley for once-through cooling, and it was, I think, 11 billion gallons a year at that time, and that was prohibited. And we've seen, that use has now declined to about 2 million gallons a year. So it's, that's had a positive effect. We continually monitor these aquifers, although our network of monitoring is not as extensive as it should be. So what we see generally are seasonal impacts because we do a lot of water withdrawal in the summer months.
Representative Jaskowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Lacusmo. Mr. Lacusmo, as you look at the dynamics of the aquifer, has the aquifer and all its contributing variables had the ability to buffer its capacity against the drawing of water that is currently being done by the 264 wells that we are looking at here? Does it recharge naturally given the consumption that's coming out of the aquifer? Are there issues with that, or does it seem to recharge each year okay? Mr. Lakasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Druskowski. There is recharge annually. That's very difficult to quantify, and it's hard to put a number on that. There is monitoring of levels, and we, like I said, we've seen seasonal declines. We've seen some declines in this aquifer. But I don't know that we've seen significant declines in this aquifer as far as elevation. Maybe I'm going to get corrected here. So we'd have to provide that monitoring information. One of these charts here that shows the amount of water withdrawn from this aquifer, and it's remained relatively constant. It's around 12 billion gallons for the seven county metropolitan area, and about 25 billion for the entire aquifer statewide. So about half of it comes out of the metropolitan area. But that's just the quantity removed. That's not reflecting the aquifer levels.
Any further comment? Mr. Lockes?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in this Savage area, Shakopee Savage area, there is evidence there of a long-term decline in the aquifer, the head of the aquifer above the top of the aquifer, of about 100 feet. So, it is declining in certain areas.
And Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lakasmo or Mr. Japs could answer. I mean, could you describe for us or confirm for me that the Mount Simon Aquifer is sort of bowl shape in the sense that it's at a lower elevation or a greater depth underneath the metro area, but then it comes to the head, at least on the north side of up in Chisago County. So it's you're dealing with something that's close to the surface, so if you overdo it on pumping in Chisago County, let's say, with a large commercial user, you may see that drop more pronounced than it would be somewhere else.
Mr. Lakasmo.
That's why we're protecting that aquifer, not just in the metro, but outside, because it comes closer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, yes, you are correct. And if you looked at that one map, in the darker shaded area that shows the Mount Simon-Hinckley, that's the likely recharge area of the aquifer. In the other parts of this map, the lighter shaded areas, there's aquifers above that in the layer cake of aquifers in the metropolitan area. So the real recharge area is the shallower area of this aquifer that's darker shaded on this map.
And just as a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lakasmo, would it then be... would it also be fair to say that if the legislature hadn't passed this as part of the Groundwater Protection Act in 1989, and if we hadn't moved away from the once-through cooling system, that the sustainability of that aquifer would have been in doubt? But now that we made those changes, we can actually sustain the uses that we have now, more or less.
Mr. Lakasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, there certainly would have been greater impacts whether or not it would bring the whole sustainability of the aquifer into that great of a question.
Okay.
But there was a...
So maybe if I could just... if I could just wrap up the point. If a large-scale commercial user, or residential user for that matter, were to be added to the number of permittees that was drawing down the Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer as was proposed in Chisago County, we'd kind of be back to where we were 20 years ago when we had... I mean, we're trying to live within our means, essentially, with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, a large user would certainly negate the positive benefits that we've made by limiting the once-through cooling.
Okay, thank you.
And to this point, Representative Gardner, you might have heard me bellyache a little bit about the... about the loss of a potential 330 job project in North Branch, Michael Foods, the Simply Potatoes hash browns you can buy in the freezer. They have been forced to relocate, I think, as the Gophers Stadium, not the Twins, I can't remember which, but and ultimately ended up in Chaska after looking in North Branch. And the reason why we were not able to get them is the cost of securing good water in North Branch. It's right on, it's actually, you look at the map and you can see that there's multiple fingers and Chisago County, up by Center City, a little bit north of there. It's very, very difficult, and actually we're doing the hydrologic, the geologic maps of our aquifer as we speak, and funded by state dollars. And the project went to Chaska and had Chaska not had access to the sewer transfer from the Metropolitan Council mechanism, that we might have not had them in Minnesota. And the challenge there is that if we, and they would not have, I think, drawn 100 million gallons of water a year from that aquifer if they could access it, but the challenge was actually being able to know that that water would be there. And so for future economic development, I understand the sort of first blush. It turns out the second blush is that really protecting this aquifer is critical for economic development as well as for the quality and quantity of our water generally.
Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Eakin. Just had a kind of a technical question, but I'm just looking at my chart here, and Flint Hills is in my district, and a lot of the neighboring cities such as Apple Valley and Inver Grove Heights and Eagan are in here, but I don't see Rosemont in here. So I'm just wondering, are they going off a different aquifer, even though geographically the same as Flint Hills, or am I maybe missing in the number of wells here?
Mr. Locke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sterner. If they aren't on the list, I presume they are from a different aquifer.
Okay, so even if it's Flint Hills in the district, they can access maybe that way those aquifers are layering over the top, maybe don't go as deep with it then.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brett.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And that kind of gets at the question I had, too. This map really expands the area where these permits would not be issued for the Mount Simon Aquifer. So my question is, are there other aquifers above the area where they could access water, or would this preclude any large water user from locating in this really entire southeastern part of the state?
Mr. Locke,
Mr. Chairman, the light shaded area on the state map is the area where there are other aquifers above the Mount Simon. So there may be one, there may be several, depending on where you are in that area. And the Prairie du Chien Jordan is the major bedrock aquifer in the southeast part of the state, and that's the aquifer where most entities take their water from.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
So could a large user tap that aquifer and start up a business, for example, in this shaded area?
Mr. Locke,
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Representative, next, Representative Arguinius.
Thank you. One of the things that we should be thinking about, too, Representative Anderson, is that some entities, like an ethanol plant, large water user can use sewage water that's been treated specifically, finished specifically for them. And so we had in our water bill last year monies that could be used to upgrade sewage water to be used. So aquifers are not our only option, and in some places in the state where there isn't much groundwater, we need to be helping businesses with other options, and that, I think, is a good one right now.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Arguinius is prescient, or she's actually read the proposed cooling strategy for that LS power proposal. If the county board proceeds with it tomorrow night, they're actually going to be using about 1.1 million gallons of gray water from the joint sewage treatment ponds 3 miles away and piping it up and then I think they're actually going to be evaporating it in the end, so they don't have to pipe it back. I can't remember exactly how they're doing it, but they're actually not using state dollars. It's a half a trillion or half a billion dollar. I'm having trouble with my zeros today. Half a billion dollar private investment if the county board decides to proceed. But initially they chose to do the easier route, which was just pop a hole into the aquifer and take 5 million gallons of water a day. Because of the interest in going down this route and even talking about the bill, they went back to the drawing board and realize that it's actually much more economical and stable for them to go with a gray water system and air cooling mixed with it. It's been pretty impressive to see them accommodate, frankly, more conservative approach.
And Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lockersmoe, I would just, Director, I'd like to follow up on Representative Anderson's question. So if you're in the dark gray area that we have, does that mean you don't have access to another aquifer like where we are? I know in Hastings we have a couple different aquifers we potentially can access. But do the people in the dark gray only have one aquifer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, there's only one bedrock aquifer there. There may be some little superficial pockets of sand that contain water, but there's really only one major aquifer in that darker shaded area. But you may have some shallow small aquifers.
Representative McNamara.
So, Mr. Chair and Director Lockersmoe, if I can follow up then. So, like in the city of Winona, there's like four or five different, including the city itself, and there's Peerless Chain, and there was one or two other Winona manufacturing companies. So you would not be able to bring a new business to Winona that would have a need for over 100 million gallons if that's their only aquifer. They would have to, if they didn't have a way to reuse or recycle and keep under that, that business would need to relocate somewhere else or locate somewhere else. Wouldn't be able to consider this?
Mr. Chairman, if you're looking at Winona, they would have an option, a surface water source of the Mississippi River, potentially, or other aquifers.
Okay.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Director Lockersmoe, if that's available, why wouldn't the city of Winona do like the city of Minneapolis and get their water out of the Mississippi, and why would Peerless Chain pump water from way deep in the ground if they can just get surface water? Are those options that are available to them, and why would they not be utilizing them today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, it's probably an issue of cost, and I would expect that they've chosen the most cost-effective option for their use, and it may depend on what level of treatment they need for the water that they're using in their company, and they could just get by with their own well without buying treated water from the city.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director Lockersmoe, so like Peerless Chain might need the water. I was envisioning they were using it to cool their production of making chains, and it wouldn't matter if it was river water or well water. You're saying it might matter, and they would have to treat the river water potentially?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I'm not sure what their use of water is and what their needs and what quality, so I really can't answer.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you. I'm just wondering, and my question now is for the author. Representative Kalin, have you heard from either labor, industry, the Chamber of Commerce, their feelings on the bill?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard from the pipe fitters, actually who've been big proponents of the power plant, and they expressed great pride in their role in identifying the withdrawal from the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer in the metro area during the 80s that led, according to their version of the story, that led to the 89 Groundwater Act. And like I said, the only folks that I heard from with any concern at all, besides the Farm Bureau and the DNR, were a few well drillers who were in my office. We shared some information. They spoke with Senator Olsen, and I had and the amendment was included in the Senate, and I did not hear from them after the amendment was put on. So I have not heard from the Chamber of Commerce or anybody else on the bill.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
So if I understand you right, the trade said they support the bill?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I haven't specifically asked them for support, and I'm happy to sit down with them and you to any concerns before we take up the bill on the floor. But the pipe fitters, like I said, did have great pride in seeing as how they put together pipes that handle our water, in kind of flagging that there may have been a danger if we went down the road as we had been going down in the late 80s.
And any other questions? I see none.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lockishmore, I'm still curious about the water withdrawal. You mentioned 100 feet drop in water level. It says somewhere on one of these sheets that the depth of the aquifer is 940 feet. So that would be about a 1/9 drop at that one particular location. Is that what we were talking about?
Mr. Lockesmoke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, when you finish a well into the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer, the water level rises in the well a certain distance because it's under pressure when you drill down to this elevation that's 900 feet below the surface of the ground. And what we're talking about is a decline in that head that's developed in the well. And we can provide some specific information to the committee and to you on the results of the observation wells and the changes that we've seen in this aquifer.
Any other questions? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, have you talked to any businesses that are in areas that will be impacted? I've got the city of Goodview and Kellogg, Wabasha is right next to my district. I know the city of Winona is right next to my district. You go down the river, La Crescent is in there. Red Wing, Lake City, all in areas that are impacted by this. A lot of cities up in your district, Representative Faust District, at Pine City, Amora, Elk River, Buffalo, Glencoe, Gaylord, New Ulm, St. James, Jackson. These are all areas that are in that area that is going to limit them under your bill. And I know you testified that you hadn't heard from any of the businesses. Of course, there's 3,000 bills in front of the legislature. But I do know some of the owners of some of the folks at Peerless Chain, Winona is an example that Representative McNamara brought up, and I don't know for sure that they're familiar with this bill. I'm curious if you've talked to any of the businesses, any of those communities that would be impacted by this.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, I have. I've also talked to our local county economic development authority executive director, who's put together projects monthly, as well as to my many electeds. I mean, the power plant has gotten a lot of discussion, especially on the issue of water, and every comment that I've had has been supportive of limiting access to this very deep, clean, older water, and essentially relying on innovation in other ways, like gray water and other, to meet those needs.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2634, as amended, be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. And next, Representative Olin. I will move House File 353 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And Representative Olin, this is the bill that's so nice. We've passed it twice. This is the third time through.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, this bill was passed in the last session, 2008, and never got a hearing because of timing. In last year, in 2009, this same committee passed this bill to the House floor. But at that time, for logistic problems, the Senate never acted on it. So at the end of the session, it went into an interim situation, got sent back to this committee. Well, the Senate has now acted on it, and I waited till the Senate did take action on it till before I brought this back to ensure that they were going to. They have acted on it. They passed it on out of their committees, and now I'm back asking that we send it back to the House floor again. Basically, all it does is transfer control of the impaired waters at recommendation of pollution control over to the International Joint Commission, because quite frankly, when you deal with the Lake of the Woods, the Lake of the Woods area is probably 25% maybe Minnesota. The rest of it, it's Canadian, and it's in international waters, and we need to go through the International Joint Commission for any examination report on water quality, and that's all this bill does is recommend send it back to where it belongs.
Any questions at all? Any concerns or opposition? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 353 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. I'm happy I could get out of here in a short time instead of a long time like the last ones. Have a good day.
Thank you. And let's see, next we have House File 3190, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move House File 3190. I don't know what your plans are for where you'd like to send it. Maybe the Finance Committee? I'm not sure.
That would be correct. Yes, the Finance Committee. So Representative Hackbarth moves House File 3190 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would move the 2380 amendment to get it in the shape I'd like.
Okay. Representative Hackbarth moves the 2380 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a little ATV bill that we've got this year. It's brought to us by All-Terrain Vehicle or Association of Minnesota, right? And I have their representative with me today, and I'll go through the bill. The it's just some clarifications, really, on a couple of topics. The very first one here in Section 1 is a clarification of the ATV seasons. And this was something that Senator Chaudhry put into law a couple of years ago. And this, I believe he's on board with these clarifications and changing these and just making it more of a seasonal restriction and closing down certain areas during certain times, mainly during rifle season for deer hunting. The next section has to do with off-road motorcycles and non-resident youth off-road motorcycle riding and the training that's required by non-resident youth in the state of Minnesota. This just simply says that if they have this safety course through the Motorcycle Safety Foundation that they will be able to ride if they're 16 years or less. And the next section is pretty much the same thing, only for ATVs. And it says if you're a non-resident and you're 12 years old or younger and you have a safety course offered by the ATV Safety Institute that you can ride in Minnesota. Or 12 years older, I'm sorry. And then the last section is about has to do with the non-resident trail pass that we passed last year. It was last year, wasn't it? And we're clarifying here that if you're a non-resident and you're operating a machine that's registered in the state of Minnesota, that you don't need to have the trail pass as long as you're on a machine that was registered in the state of Minnesota. So that takes care of that issue. And then there's the amendment that we adopted. And the amendment that we adopted is have to do with youth that are participating in organized races, those kinds of things, organized contest in the state of Minnesota. If you're 12 years or younger, this just clarifies that you can participate if you're 12 years or younger in these organized contests. And that's pretty much the bill. And we'll stand for questions.
Okay, thanks, Representative Hackbarth. Any questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hackbarth, on the amendment on the 12 years or under, is there a minimum age like 5 or something, or is it 12 down to 0?
And Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen, I don't think there is a minimum age, but maybe Mr. Bone can comment to that.
Mr. Bone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, there is no limit to the younger ages. It mirrors the same for motorcycles and snowmobiles. There are restrictions on being able to reach handlebars and correctly fit the machine, but there's not an age restriction for younger riders.
And Mr. Bone, if you could identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Jonathan Bone, representing the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota and the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association, District 23.
Thank you. And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm looking on 2.20, and that notwithstanding paragraph A section, are we giving more rights to folks who are non-residents? I'm having trouble following this language because it's not parallel. Are we giving more rights to non-residents less than 16 years of age than residents less than 16 years of age?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Representative Wagenius. No, what we're trying to do is get everyone to have some kind of safety training. And if these youth have this safety training, they don't live in our state, but if they come to our state and they have this course, we're going to say that this is takes the place of the course that we have in the state of Minnesota. As long as they're coming here, they're probably going to come here for a weekend or maybe a week to ride. As long as they have this safety training course, they can ride on our trails. I think that's what you're trying to say. We do have this course in Minnesota. It's a very good course for youth training in Minnesota now.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, but here there are two things that I'm picking up that look different to me, and I may be missing it. One of it here, we bring in waters. Is waters brought in for the rest of it? Says, okay. I see that they have to have a valid off-highway motorcycle safety certificate, but for like E above, you have to be accompanied by an 18-year-old. That doesn't apply to F?
Representative Hackbarth.
President Bondi, or Mr. Bondi, understand what you're trying to say there?
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Bone.
The way that we intended this language to be was that they would still have to follow all of the same rules that a resident would have to follow. They just would be able to complete that safety training in their home state and then come here and ride legally. So if that's not what the law says, we don't have any intention of not having them follow the same rules.
Would that require then that they add the that the language be added, that they have to be accompanied by a person 18 years? Well, council could answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members, as far as I read it, I don't believe they are being exempted from the rest of the requirements. They're just being exempted from the requirements in paragraph A. So I think it is as intended.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, that's the way I read it, too, that they still have to meet all the other requirements. This just has to do with the safety training course.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Sterner.
Just to clarify, maybe it covered it, but will this cover the new electric ATV that Polaris is making with this new bill here, or is that some language that can be added to it?
Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sterner, the electric ATV, I believe, was would be legal under a provision that was added in the DNR policy bill. I don't remember the House file off the top of my head, that increased the weight limits and the engine size for a legal ATV. Our provisions here are just relating to the definition of ATVs in general. So as long as that provision is passed, then it would include that ATV under the definition of ATVs in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowen, you and I talked, I think, last year on some ATV issues, and I believe I mentioned to you that some townships, at least a township that I live in, has an ATV ordinance allowing ATVs to ride on the road, on township roads, but not in the ditches. Mm-hmm. So we're tired of paying taxpayer money to fix up the intersections where they're getting torn up. Does this, the course, online coursework, does that include information to ATV users that check for local ordinances, that there may be differences than just, I'm looking at 2-20 there, and you know, notwithstanding, a non-resident less than 16 years of age may operate an off-highway motorcycle on public lands or waters if it's a non-resident use, and they got a completing safety efficiency course. My question: Are we teaching the youth that there may be variances here locally?
Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, in the training courses, it is stated, obviously these are for non-residents, so I would presume that it would say check for local regulations. These safety classes are focused on how to use the machines correctly as to not harm yourself or put others in harm. But these will be non-residents coming into the state, and they will have a certain amount of responsibility on themselves to make sure that they know all of the local and state regulations.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think it's prudent, and I don't know if you're involved with ATV safety, I know, and I'm glad about that, and instruction, and I think it's prudent to have something, some kind of mention of that in these safety courses, because it indeed could be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Purcell. I am a ATV safety instructor, and it is included in the Minnesota course that they have to watch for these local ordinances and regulations and those kinds of things.
Thank you.
And Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, we're also working with the Department of Natural Resources on a current statute that has to do with reciprocity of training programs from other states. Currently, we don't have reciprocity with any other states, but we do have the ability to create that. And through that program, I believe that DNR will be focusing on how to work with those states to make sure that they are stressing learning the regulations of where you're riding and how to do that legally and as safe as possible. And we're hoping that in the near future, they'll start to advance that process, and we'll get reciprocity with other states.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth renews his motion that House File 3190 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance as amended. Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Coonan. And I will move House File 2957 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And I understand you have no amendment to this one. So, Representative Coonan, to the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. What the bill does is exempt Indian tribal governments from registering or licensing watercraft, off-highway vehicles, and snowmobiles. Current law exempts off-highway motorcycles, off-road vehicles, snowmobiles, and all-terrain vehicles and watercraft that are owned and used by the United States, the state, or a political subdivision from registering or licensing these vehicles. This bill adds Indian tribal government to the list of government that receive these registration exemptions. The bill brings Indian tribal governments in line with other governments, and that's a quick overview of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Any questions at all for the author? Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if there's a fiscal note to this, or will there be? But I'm assuming it's going to Representative Wagenius, this committee, and I know there are fiscal questions. I just want to make sure at some point that we know what the impact is to the DNR's budget and such.
Yes, and Representative Coonan, you want to respond?
I understand it's going to Representative Wagenius' committee, and we'll need a fiscal note there. So.
So, any other questions? See, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coonan, I'd be interested. What brought the bill forward? Why do we want to select one group of people in Minnesota and exempt them from these licenses?
Representative Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this was brought to me by from Upper Sioux, which is in Yellow Medicine County, and they their licensing is done through the state. I understand there are some tribes that do their own licensing, but now you're starting to get out of my area of expertise. But theirs is done through the state, and they just wanted to be treated the same as other units of government in the area, and that's why they brought it.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion to House File 2957.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Meyer, DNR, really quickly. We do need to work with the author on just a technical amendment. I'm going to give him the language for this. The Coast Guard, the watercraft piece, we need to petition to the Coast Guard for written approval to be able to do that for licensed tribal official boats, the tribal government boats. We just need to work with the U.S. Coast Guard on that. So I'm going to give the author the amendment that we need to put on the bill at the next stop. The Senate language, however, allows tribal members to be exempt from that registration. For watercraft, we aren't going to be able to do that. So we're going to have to just make sure that you're aware of that over here, and we'll work with that and the other body to deal with that concern as well. So,
okay.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to make sure we can fix that at the next stop.
No problem. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. So, any questions at all?
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, do you know the fiscal impact of the bill? As long as you came down, I was going to ask.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we haven't calculated a fiscal note on it. It will be minimal at best. I mean, there's not a lot of these at the government level that are registered right now.
Representative McNamara.
And just a quick follow-up, but if on the House floor they made an amendment to put in the Senate language exempts all members of the tribes, is that what you said, for all their vehicles that they would own covered under the bill?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, it does currently. I will get you that information and make sure that you're aware of it, both the author and yourself, what that would be. I don't have those numbers with me right now.
Representative Purcell.
Mr. Meyer, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, how many of the tribes issue their own licenses to tribal members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eakin, for motor vehicles?
For these ATVs, boats, etc.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm not sure of that question. I'll do a little research and get back to that as well. Okay.
Any other questions? Anyone else have any concerns? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2957 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And next, House File 3190, Representative Scalzi. We are not going to be moving this bill. Okay, sorry.
Wrong number. Well, I'm sure Scalzi loved the
3406. House File 3406, and we are not going to be moving this bill. This is just informational. So, Representative Scalzi, welcome to the committee and to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I used to be a member of this committee. It's kind of nice to be back. This bill, House File 3406, relates to the Lower St. Croix National Scenic Riverway. There is in your packets a Star Tribune article, and there is also in your packets an amendment, and that's titled A-10-2364. And that amendment reflects some comments that we got from the League of Minnesota Cities to where I took this bill, because being on a city council for so many years as I was, I know that that's one place that we really have to do to send a bill like this. The St. Croix River is one of the original rivers in federal law, and it's got a 37-year history of people thinking that this wording was in law. And this bill puts into words the authority that we assumed that the DNR had, but has recently been changed by a court decision. So with that, we're going to hear from some testifiers. The first one is Bill Clapp from the St. Croix River Association.
Mr. Clapp, if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Bill Clapp, that's spelled C-L-A-P-P. I'm speaking today for the St. Croix River Association. The St. Croix River Association is having its 100th anniversary next year. We understand that we're the oldest conservation organization in the state. We've got 250 members or so. Most of them live in the St. Croix River Valley. Their interest is the St. Croix River, as is mine. My family has had property on the St. Croix in Scandia, 3 miles north of Marine, 15 miles north of Stillwater, for 95 years. And I personally love the St. Croix River very much. So this recent decision in the court case has caught our interest. Now, as you've heard already, the St. Croix was one of the very first rivers put into the National Wild and Scenic River System. The lower St. Croix part of it, from Taylor's Falls South, was put in 1972. Part of the deal was that the states would establish zoning standards for the part of the river downstream from Taylor's Falls and St. Croix Falls, downstream all the way down to the Mississippi. Each state, accordingly, enacted laws directing their respective departments of natural resources to establish minimum zoning standards, which were to be adopted and administered by the zoning authorities along the riverway with DNR oversight. Such rules were adopted by the states and then by the local governments. And as you've been told, we've been operating under that scheme for over 30 years. I believe you said 37?
I did.
Okay. So it was a bit of a surprise when the court decision came down and told us that something we've been doing all that time wasn't right. The zoning system that was established set up minimum lot sizes, setbacks from the shore of the river, setbacks from bluff tops, building heights, etc. And it provided that variances from those standards had to be agreed to by DNR before they could become effective. When DNR would not approve a variance, the zoning authority and the landowner could challenge that decision in a relatively inexpensive and prompt administrative proceeding before an administrative law judge. The administrative law judge would make a recommendation to the commissioner of DNR, who would make a final decision on the variance. The commissioner's decision could be challenged by appeal to court. Now, the state Supreme Court has ruled that the state's Lower St. Croix River Act, which directed DNR to establish a set of minimum zoning standards, did not empower the DNR to include in those standards authority for the DNR to have a final say on variance grants. So now, given that court decision, a challenge to a local government's decision to grant a variance must be directed by appeal to the court without any intervening administrative decision. This puts the local government directly in the line of fire. It and the landowner must defend its variance approval in court before the local government could act as the nice guy, okaying a variance, counting on the DNR to say no, and the DNR to then defend its decision in the administrative law judge proceeding. Now, the local variance grant may be challenged in court by the DNR or the St. Croix River Association or the Sierra Club or a displeased neighbor of the landowner, and the local government has to take on the burden of defending its decision in court. This puts the local government in an unfair position. It is being asked to play the heavy to deny variances in order to protect the river, the National Scenic Riverway. This riverway is a national asset, which the DNR has been defending on behalf of all Minnesotans. With the court's decision, the burden of managing the development of the river's shores in the interest of preserving and protecting this scenic asset, often referred to as a national treasure, is left on purely local shoulders. The St. Croix River Association thinks that that is an awful lot to ask of little communities like Lake St. Croix Beach and St. Mary's Point and Lakeland Shores and Bayport and townships who choose to do their own zoning. Not only a lot to ask, but also a lot to expect of those local governments. We must remember that these zoning standards were imposed on the local governments. They did not have the choice of adopting them or not, the choice of opting out. We think it is a bit much to expect a local government to properly enforce a land use system that was not its own idea. We don't think it is realistic to think that local communities will shoulder this added burden even if the DNR steps up its community education effort. These are times of tight budgets, and what local government welcomes litigation? When small communities only encounter a riverway zoning application infrequently and have extremely limited staff, how are they even to know their own ordinance, much less know when variances are justified? I am not arguing today for any particular piece of legislation, and we understand that the timing is such that there's not going to be any this year on this subject. For the rest of the year, we can see how things go, see how the local governments make out, see if DNR provides them the additional support that they need now that they're more on their own. If things go all right, if our concerns prove unwarranted, that's terrific. But if not, it is probable that we will be seeking some legislation next year to restore the situation to what it has been for the last 37 years. I thank you. Now, it might be that rather than ask questions of me now, maybe you'd like to hear from Mr. Hottinger, who's going to speak more specifically to some of this subject.
Welcome, Mr. Hottinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Hottinger. I live in St. Paul. I'm here as the volunteer chair of the Executive Committee of the Minnesota Sierra Club, North Star Chapter of the Sierra Club. And I've just had my testimony cut in half because Mr. Clapp has done an excellent job, which is to your benefit. Mr. Clapp has done an excellent job of outlining the reason that Representative Scalzi put forward this bill. And I am in here in support of this bill, including an amendment that has been worked out to alleviate some of the concerns from local governments. The Sierra Club and the St. Croix River Association intervened in the litigation that resulted in this Supreme Court decision in an effort to support the DNR in its denial of the variance. The specifics of the case are instructive as a case study to understand why DNR oversight over local decision-making here has been the practice for nearly 40 years. And it's essential to uphold the protections required by state statute and by federal law of the Wild and Scenic Rivers, and specifically the Lower St. Croix. In the litigation involved, plans were submitted proposing to replace an old 900-square-foot cabin with a three-story, 16,000-square house to be located directly in the river bluff. This replacement of a non-conforming structure with obviously more visual conspicuous home is what was presented to the Lakeland City Council. The Lakeland Planning Commission denied the request for a variance, but the City Council approved it. And I think Mr. Clapp has outlined the extreme pressures on the local government trying to enforce an ordinance that it may not have had a choice in adopting. But that ordinance would have required Lakeland to enforce its 40-foot bluff line setback ordinance, one of the many ordinances the homeowner was seeking. Now, that ordinance, in effect, was mandated in state law by the rules of the DNR. One of the key provisions of the DNR rules and the local ordinances, which cities such as Lakeland were required to adopt, included this kind of setback, and as a result of the national and the Minnesota laws enforcing the protections in the lower St. Croix. Now, there are many reasons for those kinds of ordinances, including protecting unstable sandy bluffs from further erosion and deterioration, providing continuous natural buffers between development of the river to help protect water quality, and something that I feel uniquely about, preserving existing scenic blue views of the blufflands from the river. I grew up with an uncle and two cousins who ran a marina in Prescott and came to enjoy the St. Croix River immensely from my youth. And last summer, I allowed the St. Croix River to introduce me to kayaking, showing old dogs can learn new tricks, but also reminding me of the beauty of that river, especially floating down it in the fall. And the beauty was from the river, enjoying the scenic vistas. With all of this in mind, Lakeland's Planning Commission recommended denying the homeowner's request. The City Council overruled that recommendation, and the DNR found, as a result of this lawsuit, that despite its objections, that decision by the local council couldn't be changed even if the DNR certified the variance, because the DNR didn't have the authority in the statute to do that. It should be noted that DNR normally certifies these requests. A denial of certification is a very rare occurrence over the 40-year time frame of this St. Croix River protection. It illustrates the fact that this authority is used by the DNR only in extreme circumstances where local governments won't or can't serve as the sole enforcement mechanism. Specifying DNR oversight of local government responses to variance requests is necessary and is appropriate and is contained in quite a bit of legislation dealing with river protection. There seems to have been an oversight in this original legislation by not including what's included in Representative Scalzi's bill. Without that check and balance, the riverway's natural and recreational values, which have brought residents and visitors and tourists to the St. Croix Valley, will not just suffer what Walter Mondale termed a death by Nixon cuts, but be ruined by wholesale exploitation for the benefit of few. The court's reasoning makes the solution clear. And if you have a question about this and you have the opportunity, since we won't be voting today, to read the Supreme Court decision, they all but invite this legislation because they point out other rivers are protected by the ability of DNR to certify or not certify these types of variances. The bill essentially places the DNR rule that was struck down by the court into statute. As you continue this discussion, we hope you also have the opportunity to consider the impact of Minnesota's other wild and scenic rivers. The amendment language, which has been prepared and which at the appropriate time Representative Scalzi will be offering, language was changed to narrow the focus of the bill, specifically to the variance certification, which is the authority that was specifically struck down by the court decision. And in Representative Scalzi's amended bill, all that is being sought is to seek to restore the authority to the department that they thought, everybody else thought, they had for the past 40 years. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, good to see you. Thanks for being back here. Unfortunately, I don't think we see this issue the same. And I will apologize up front if I offend you in some of my questioning. It's not personally. I actually like you a lot. I just don't necessarily agree with some of the things you're bringing forward here. I'm wondering if I don't know if Director Lacashmo wants to come up or just pay attention for some of the questions I'd like to ask. I think Senator Hottinger, if I remember right, and I'm not sure if you or one of the staff of Sierra Club know, but in the Butch and Diane Davies situation, which was a constituent of mine, that Senator Sieben's father, Mike Sieben, and I worked real hard on. Mike was the original author of this legislation in the 80s, when it passed, and we had to work real hard with Director Lacashmo to get the Davies to get a permit to build a home where they were taking down two homes and the vista was going to be much better after the fact than before. But if I remember right, the Sierra Club worked real hard to not allow that permit to move forward. And I'm just wondering, was that not the position of the Sierra Club on that case?
Mr. Hottinger.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buckthorn Buster McNamara.
You remember.
I remember. I can't answer your question. I don't know. I took over as the executive committee chair last year and don't know that history of what you're talking about. It sounds to me that it's a pretty dramatically different situation than the one that was presented to the Supreme Court. And I guess the question may be, and I don't know the answer, whether or not that variance ended up being certified by DNR. If it did, then this wouldn't impact it.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I believe there was a lot of similarities. You know, I'm not sure how much difference there was. I've looked at both of them. I think there's a lot of similarities. I really believe that we need to have some local control. We had a case in both these cases where local government had weighed in, and I think we have to be real careful here as we go forward. And I guess I know it's just before us informationally, but I will tell you, in the Valley, the local municipalities want to have local control and want to work within the guidelines of this important river. And we have to have some common sense. And Senator, I'm going to be real careful here, but Mr. Chair and Senator, I hope your group will come back to the table and work with the state of Wisconsin and the state of Minnesota to find a solution to get that bridge built. Members, I'm talking about the bridge over the St. Croix. Your group, you're a good person, Senator, and you could make it happen by coming together and bringing folks. We've been fighting this since the 90s when it was a $100 million bridge. It's now a $500 million bridge. Your organization could make the difference here. And I just want to thank you for coming and testifying, but please bring the message back to your group that we need to get back to the table and find a solution. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
And Mr. Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Backemeyer. I know you say that in good faith, and I like you, and I respect you, and I've enjoyed working with you. And although that litigation started long before my tenure at the Sierra Club, let me emphasize this. The Sierra Club is not against building a bridge. And I think the Sierra Club is always open to try and find the best way to get it done. That may be the discussion, but that can be talked at the table. So good suggestion, Representative.
Any questions? Any more questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much. And we do have next Mr. Craig Johnson and Mr. Todd Olson. Welcome. And Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I'd like to start off by thanking Representative Scalzi for working with us over the past couple of weeks on reviewing the legislation that you're talking about today. The Delete All Amendment is, in fact, in response to a request the League of Minnesota Cities made to scale the language down to deal specifically with the Hubbard decision, which was focused on variance certification. What I would like to add, though, is that, and this has been covered briefly by some other testimony, the certification process is not the only way we deal with issues of local control on waterfront issues. In the rest of the state, where you're not on a wild and scenic river, we still have state shoreline rules that local governments have to be in compliance with. If a local government chooses to pass an ordinance, amend an ordinance, do rezoning, or give a variance that in any way conflicts with those state minimum protections, the DNR has the authority to go to district court and challenge that decision, just like other interested parties do. Our local governments are very used to working with that, and obviously they take that into account when it comes time to make a decision on how shoreland is going to be used. And frankly, it's worked pretty well with most of them. There only occasionally are cases that have to go to court to be resolved. So I don't think it would be the crisis of liability that some people are concerned about with the St. Croix. I think it would work very similarly. People would be used to dealing with their local decisions and them being responsible for it. They are elected officials. They're used to being held responsible both in liability and by their electorate, by their constituents, for the decisions that they're elected to make. I do want to point out again that even the new shoreland rules that we're discussing for the state that are currently in draft continue to use that process where the DNR gets notified of all local decisions before they're made. That information gets to them in a time that they can make comments to the decision-making body before a final decision is made, and then DNR can choose to challenge that decision if they feel it was being made inappropriately. So while we are very grateful for the work that Representative Scalzi has done with us on this bill, we generally don't feel that it's necessary. We do have shoreline protections throughout the state that work very well. The process works fine there. We think it could work fine here. We'll probably get some examples over the next year to find out. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay, thanks. And Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Todd Olson. I'm with Metro Cities. For the reasons Mr. Johnson stated, the protections that exist, we agree this legislation isn't necessary. The standards still exist that local ordinances must conform to. The justifications are still there that variances must meet. And we don't believe that putting this in statute is necessary.
Okay. Any questions at all for our testifiers? Okay, I see none, so thank you very much. And Representative Scalzi.
Thank you.
Yes, I just would like to say in closing, thank you for your time. I've really appreciated your attentiveness at this late hour. I do have to say, though, I spent six terms on a city council, and I recall many times where we were dealing with, I have 15 lakes in my district, and we would be dealing with a shoreland issue, and we would all say, okay, we'll okay this, but we're going to run it by the DNR first. And that was the way, as Mr. Clapp mentioned, that's a way that a local government sort of protects itself. We don't know all the science that we need to know, but the DNR does. They have people that can take care of that issue. And I just think that short of going to district court, there should be a better way for the DNR to be able to do their job. And I think that the legislation would be that way. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Scalzi, for bringing this forward. And seeing no other questions or comments, the meeting is now adjourned.